Poke check, rap check, back check, slap check. Testing, 1, 2, 3. Poke check, rap check, back check, slap check.
Welcome to the Quick Restart. We cover 73 Division I men's lacrosse teams.
And we do it fast.
Welcome back to the Inside Lacrosse Podcast. I am Terry Foy, joined by Quint Kesnick for the first time in more than a month. Quint, it's great to hear the sound of your voice. How are you, my friend?
Doing well. Fascinating stretch of the summer for me, Terry. And you're involved in it as well at across all levels, you know, whether it was seeing young kids at my camp, my goalie camp, covering Under Armour, the high school, the premier elite kids, World Series youth lacrosse, you know, the U13s, and then dealing with the pros and some high school recruiting events. It's just, I'm just fascinated and kind of stimulated by things that I'm seeing and witnessing and watching the game continue to change and adapt.
No question. It's been really the best part about this time of year is, to your point, seeing the game at multiple levels and envisioning the arc that players take as they move through their careers. But also for me, relative to the college season, when I spend a lot of time in press box, etc., get more opportunity to talk to parents, fans, families, players than you do in kind of the more rigorous or regimented part of the year. So definitely kind of resets the perspective a little bit, and it's been really exciting. But that being said, there's a lot of news in the college lacrosse landscape that's unfolded in the last 45 days, and I want to start with that. And we're going to start with the coaching changes. There have been a number of them. So in chronological, more or less, order, Joe Amplo, the former Marquette coach, named the Navy coach. Andrew Baxter, the former Yale assistant, named the Fairfield head coach. Andrew Stimmel, his co-assistant at Yale, named the Marquette coach, backfilling Joe Amplo. Anthony Gallardi, the former Towson assistant, named Stony Brook's head coach. Jerry Byrne, the Notre Dame assistant, named the Harvard head coach. And then most recently, Andy Whitley, formerly a Fairfield assistant, named the Bellarmine head coach. In addition to that, a number of notable assistant coach moves, particularly Dylan Sheridan, the Cleveland State head coach, taking Brad Ross's job at Ohio State to become an assistant there. Ryan Wellner backfilling Jerry Byrne. John Orson backfilling him at Navy. And on we go. Quint, when the table is set that way, what strikes you as the most significant?
Well, I think all the hires were shrewd, and I have enormous respect for the Andrews of Yale, and they both got jobs the same year, which puts a lot of pressure on Coach Shea now in terms of continuing the excellence that they've achieved. Stimmel's a great fit at Marquette. Baxter, I love the work he does also. Two thumbs up to that. Anthony Gallardi, I've been promoting for jobs for the last 5 years. I think the work that he did at Towson with an occasional pro player, you know, you look at a Ryan Drenner or Brennan Sunday and Woodall, they had some parts, but he really maximized that group and got them to play well late in the year. I just love his temperament, player development, and I think he's a tremendous fit at Stony Brook. Then there's Navy, Joe Amplo. Initially, I was kind of on the fence, but the more I dig deep there, and I was down in Annapolis last weekend and spent some time with Stacy Michaud, their SID, and the hiring of Brad Ross and John Orson now on that staff, that's a great group. They're going to make waves in the Patriot League. There's no doubt the support's there from Chet Gladchuk, their AD, their facilities. They just got to retain some kids and stop losing so many along the way, because, you know, Ryan Wellner had done a great job targeting young athletes. They lost a lot to NAPS. And along the way, it's an arduous trip for kids to make that that step. My brother did it. You know, I know what it's like. And so then, you know, they lose Wellner, but Notre Dame losing Jerry Byrne, I thought, was vulnerable. But they hired absolutely a brilliant hire to bring in Ryan Wellner. And so Notre Dame counters. I thought they were vulnerable when they lose a guy like Jerry Byrne, their social media, their recruiting, the franchise of that defense. And then you spin it to Harvard. And Jerry's a big plus there. And now the Ivy League is going to be just a dogfight over the next 5 years. Yale's ramped it up. Obviously, Cornell is Cornell. Princeton all of a sudden pulling in three Under Armour All-Americans this year. They're on an upward swing. And you got to think with the way Harvard can throw academic aid around and their reputation, that it's going to be tough for kids not to take visits there and not to give the Crimson a serious look. Do you agree with everything I just said? Because, I mean, I think they're all positive hires.
Absolutely. I think one of the things about this summer that feels different from the last time we had significant coach movement, which was probably 2-3 years ago at this point, we've had a couple of relatively calm summers, is that while perhaps the Harvard process drew on a little bit longer than their alums and fans would have wanted, there were
and you. You know, I think during the Under Armour game, I threw a shout out to him. I was like, "Hey, Harvard, any day now," because it was approaching 2 months. Remember, I believe that Jerry Byrne, interviewed for that job pretty soon after Notre Dame's season was over.
Right.
And then there was almost 2 full months that elapsed and they hadn't pulled the trigger. And then you wonder, like, is that a signal of dysfunction? What's going on there? Why can't they isolate and attract the prime talent? Eventually they got it right. It just took longer than expected.
Well, okay. So that's kind of the point that I wanted to make, which is that there weren't, despite, you know, accepting that one, there weren't any processes where there were notable withdrawals or any type of drama that is reminiscent to, you know, say what happened at Virginia when they were replacing Dom Starja, or even, you know, Penn State, Navy, and Maryland in terms of like all of the kind of guy being in the running and then pulling out, guy getting offered a job and then turning it down, and I guess the fan base having to look around and say, what next? So I think the reason that's significant with respect to how do each of these jobs or each of these hires make me feel is like, yeah, I mean, if the process led to the candidate that was kind of a logical choice at the outset, it suggests that, yeah, they did a really nice job. One of the lenses that I look at this through is I was really struck at the Final Four by the confluence of Penn State being led by Jeff Tamburoni and Virginia being led by Lars Tiffany, and how originally Lars had been offered the Penn State job. He had previously been an assistant there. And then after sleeping on it and getting pressured by some Brown alums to stay at Brown, chose to turn it down. And then kind of out of nowhere, a little bit out of left field, Jeff Tamburoni, who in my estimation at the time was the hottest commodity in all of college coaching, took that job. That was in the summer of 2010. So literally an entire decade has elapsed. And yet it's impossible to say that without the direction that those two guys offered their programs, and certainly this is also true for the other two Final Four teams, Duke and Yale, who had their own interesting coach development and coach search stories, just not necessarily as seamless as being the entirety of the 2010s bookended. Without those two guys leading the programs, they wouldn't have been there. And so I kind of overlaid that with this summer's coaching search, and at the expense of, you know, not giving as much credit as might be necessary to the likes of Fairfield, Marquette, Bellarmine, etc., you know, those programs, in my estimation, first need to focus on their competition within their conference. There are two jobs that were filled that I think can realistically look at themselves through the multi-year arc of becoming national championship or at least Final Four contenders, and those are Navy and Harvard. And it's no coincidence that they hired the most experienced guys to lead their job. So I think if you're a fan of either of those two programs, you need to be particularly invigorated by the job that was done. And then I suppose in that context, I would also agree with you that Notre Dame bringing in Ryan Wellner was about as good of a one-for-one replacement for Jerry Byrne as possible, because it's a defensive-oriented assistant who is tremendous on the recruiting trail. I'll be fascinated over the next 18 months to see how much Notre Dame and Harvard run into each other on the trail, because I don't think Notre Dame and Navy really did very often, because Navy is so self-selecting in terms of being a service academy kid. Whereas with Notre Dame and Harvard, you're dealing with like the highest echelon of academic kids, and you would presume that these two guys maybe stylistically are going to be pretty similar. So in that context, I see those three jobs as kind of circling each other and being really meaningful on, you know, maybe not the national championship picture in the next 3 years, but maybe from, say, 2023 to the end of the decade.
whether we want to admit it or not, there's what, 73 or 74 Division I programs?
Yep.
15 or 20 who can win a national title, let's say, right now. They're all these programs are intertwined. And when you start trading coaches, when you start moving assistants, you know, the relationship between one program to the other, as you wrote in that article, there are waves that carry on. Now, my biggest two questions looking forward, Terry, are what's the future of lacrosse at Cleveland State? Because Dylan Sheridan, I don't think, would have bailed on a program that he has sees rainbows in their future. And then what is going on at Hampton?
So I have thoughts on those two positions in particular. Now, I will concede that who ends up taking the job at Cleveland State is going to be really indicative to their future. That being said, having had conversations with Dylan, not since he took the Ohio State job, but previous to that, prior to that, I really do think it comes down to they don't have a conference. And I think that the timing of this decision suggests that Dylan didn't believe that a conference landing spot was going to present itself in the near future. He's coached this team for three seasons. They were better than multiple teams that made the NCAA tournament this year on an efficiency against strength of schedule based metric. They were better than UMBC. They deserve to be in that battling for an AQ conversation. And without a conference, they're not. And so I can understand the frustration that he, as the leader of that program, must have felt. I do think Andy German would do a nice job if he gets elevated and takes over that job. I think a guy like Jim Nagel, maybe even a guy like Rick Soule, would be interesting for Cleveland State to look at in terms of their resumes and the fact that, you know, one might presume that both of those guys are interested in being Division I head coaches again. So we'll see how it unfolds. But I think first and foremost, more important than hiring a head coach, Cleveland State has to consider and has to find itself a conference home. And one of the things that I think was a blow that was dealt, I've written at times about the idea of a new Western lacrosse-only league. And
yeah,
Bellarmine's,
Utah.
Yeah, Bellarmine's program being elevated to Division I and joining the Atlantic Sun in all sports, in my estimation, was a significant detriment to that idea. Because originally I had isolated Utah, Air Force, Bellarmine, Detroit, Mercy, and Cleveland State as five programs that pretty logically made sense as a new GWLL and then one additional team needing to be added. Now, whether that was NJIT, who has since joined the NEC, or whether it was Hampton, who remains an independent, or a new Western team that could be formed, with Bellarmine joining the ASUN in all sports, it all but assures their continued participation in the SoCon for men's lacrosse, and I think that that makes the hurdle to a new Western League even higher. It now requires two teams. So, you know, that's a TBD. Now, I bring up Hampton, and you brought them up as well. With Lloyd Carter's retirement, it opened up the search and the examination of the program by a lot of candidates. And I know that they've had a couple of guys on campus, and I know a couple of folks that originally were involved in the conversation have withdrawn because, by their saying, they didn't believe what the administration was telling
convinced.
Them about. They weren't convinced that the athletic department was committed to providing the resources necessary to create a competitive program. And that's really disappointing to hear, you know, particularly realizing that they're now entering year four of Division I varsity status, but they still haven't played a full Division I schedule. And there's a long way to go between now and then when they are capable of playing a full Division I schedule. And to this point, I don't know of a viable candidate for that job.
Yeah, that's a shame because Hampton had such great momentum. I think the opportunity is still there. And that's a shame because we were hoping that their giant leap would lead to others, but they haven't capitalized on that momentum, and it's just unfortunate.
Yeah. So despite so much interest and drama intrigue around the coaching moves, they were not the only significant news at the Division I level, as we saw a pair of high-profile transfers leave the Patriot League and join ACC destinations. First was Boston University attackman Chris Gray, who decided to spend his last 2 years of eligibility at North Carolina. And then a couple weeks later, we learned that All-American midfielder Chase Scanlon, after his freshman season at Loyola, decided that he wanted to open up and explore his options, and he will spend the remainder of his career, presumably, wearing number 22 in the Carrier Dome. Quint, what was your reaction to that, and how does this newfangled world of the transfer portal make you feel?
Well, it's here to stay, and if you don't adapt to the change, you will die as a coach, as a program. I've seen it in college football. You know, you go to ESPN.com and you call up, you know, the NCAA D1 college football transfers, and I mean, there's like 20 quarterbacks, and I'm relearning rosters for next fall in terms of football, and that wave has now hit lacrosse. It puts a lot of pressure on the coach to continually recruit his own players. Okay, that unhappy freshman who was an Under Armour All-American that rode the pines all year, he's got to sit down with that athlete and ensure them that they're on the right path. You've got to continually re-recruit your players. And potentially, in some cases, nefariously, maybe there's others that you don't mind when they submit to the transfer portal and maybe free up some money for maybe other players that would fit your program better. So it's a really delicate situation. It gives the players a lot of leverage and a lot of leeway. The ones that caught me off guard this year, Chase Scanlon leaving Loyola, completely caught me off guard. I'd covered many Loyola games this year. I thought he was comfortable, happy, and at home with that program. And then the other one was the Brandow goalie leaving Georgetown. Really caught me by surprise, considering the fact that he became a really good player at the end of the year, a key to the Hoyas run, and that just slapped me pretty good. He coached in my camp. There was no signs of him being unhappy or wanting to move.
And to my knowledge, we still don't know where Chris Brandow is going to be this next year, right?
Correct. And, you know, I don't know. I was told that there was a certain date that if he were to transfer to an Ivy that he submitted maybe too late for Ivy enrollment. Now, I'm not sure if that's true. I'm not sure what kind of loopholes exist. Could he take the fall off and enroll as a January athlete? You know, there's a lot of ways around this thing. And we just got to sit back and let it develop. But Scanlon to Syracuse is a big deal because now the Orange, I like them this year. They just couldn't turn the corner. But you add Tucker Dordovic and Chase Scanlon to that group for next year. They're in a good spot. And Loyola suddenly, between the loss of Spencer, Duffy, Stover, and Scanlon, Loyola starts from scratch next year.
Yeah. So just, I don't have a ton of thoughts on Loyola other than, well, so I do. I have two thoughts. So the first is this, you know, kind of transfer portal upgrade opportunity works both directions, or really kind of in all three directions, in the sense that they lose Scanlon, but from what I'm hearing, Loyola is a leading candidate for Riley C., the first-team All-SoCon, or SoCon Freshman of the Year midfielder from Bellarmine. Now, whether or not he chooses to stay at Bellarmine in the wake of hiring Andy Whitley is an interesting outcome that could occur. He has yet to make his decision known. But the point is that, you know, you might lose a guy to a program that is traditionally ranked higher than you, despite the fact that you had beaten them in the first round of the NCAA tournament this season. That being said, you know, maybe there's an opportunity for a program that's traditionally ranked below you. You know, there's a guy on that roster that is looking for a more competitive situation for himself. And then on the flip side, you mentioned obviously guys that are at perennial top 10, top 25 programs, not getting on the field, not finding their competitive flame satisfied. And they look around and say, you know, that program that's traditionally ranked in the 30s could really use my services, and I think that that would be a great fit for me. So I think the transfer portal navigation is about figuring out how you fit in, and I agree with your point relative to, you know, how do you re-recruit your players? How do you convince them that their situation at your program is the best one for them? And in some instances, to your point, how do you push them out the door if you need to free up their dollars or if it turns out to be beneficial that you could? I thought that Chris Gray's choice of North Carolina was the most logical one. In announcing his departure from Boston University, he cited an academic consideration. Folks saw that as an upgrade in terms of the power of the degree. I think what it had more to do with was his ability to find a major that he was looking for. And the way it was explained to me was he was not admitted into Boston University's business school. So by transferring to Carolina, he might be able to graduate with a business degree. And from a lacrosse standpoint, you know, I'm very fascinated to see how that unfolds, because when I think about Dave Metzbauer-led offenses, whether they be at Princeton or at North Carolina, the one thing that the good offenses had in common was a commanding presence at X, whether it be a feeder or a dodger, somebody that was able to consistently draw slides and facilitate the ball. And while Andy Matthews did that job in yeoman's way over the course of the last 3 years, you know, they haven't been the same since graduating Zach Pontrello. And I think that Chris Gray is the closest thing that they will have seen to that. And so when you complement him with the midfield scoring that guys like William Perry and Justin Anderson provide, and then round that out with the sophomore leaps that you would hope that guys like Brian Cameron or Nicky Solomon or Jacob Kelly might make, then all of a sudden you start to see a Tar Heel offense that, you know, complemented by the return of, you know, a really highly ranked defensive recruit that was on the cover of our magazine, recruiting issue of the magazine, and Will Bowen, who missed the season due to an ACL tear. And then a guy that I was told was one of the most under-ranked players in a freshman goaltender.
Was that the goalie?
Yeah.
And you want, no, and they bring in a nice Under Armour Fogo to complement a strong freshman season
Zach Tucci,
in that regard.
Yeah.
So they're on the way up.
Yep.
In terms of the transfers, Terry, I can't criticize any of these young men for making a change. You know, T.D. Irwin's last year or the guys this year. Again, I lived through it, there were moments in my freshman year where I got back to my dorm room and I said to myself, I don't belong here. I'm not happy here. And you just got to ride out through those downtimes, whether it's academically, socially, or lacrosse-wise. And again, lacrosse is only going to be one piece of this puzzle. That's an important thing to remember. You know, do you fit in on campus? Do you fit in the locker room? Do you feel like you're making positive movements, you know, towards your sophomore, junior, and senior year? And every athlete's going to have moments as a freshman where they're saying, man, maybe I shouldn't have gone here. Maybe, you know, the grass is always greener. But, you know, you got to fight it out, and you got to trust the people around you. Go into the assistant coach's office and develop relationships with your assistant coaches. Stay in contact with your head coach and try to develop as many friends on the team as possible and talk about these things. Because it's honestly, it's not unusual for players to be homesick or unhappy at a time during their freshman year.
Sure. So I just wanted to chip in a little bit around Chase Scanlon, because I'm really fascinated by the player that he's going to become. When he chose Syracuse, I tweeted that I was surprised, looking at all of his goals this year, how many of them came as a feet set righty shooter. He was awesome on the fast break, particularly off of faceoff. That was the way that Loyola started using him later in the season. It was clear that early in the year he was more of a dodger, and then teams started to recognize that and put the pull on him. And he became more of a backside finisher. I think he was injured late in the year. I think that limited his mobility a little bit. And so when you transpose that over the next 3 years at Syracuse, you know, I do think that he has the capacity, because he is an electric ball carrier, and his stick protection is so good. But he's a short dodger. He's not a long dodger. And I'm not sure that he's yet shown the capacity to feed off the dodge consistently. And so I'm not sure that, I guess my question is, I don't know what Syracuse fans imagine him being relative to that traditional number 22, you know, because typically it's been a dual threat player, you know, somebody whose stat line is going to be pretty close in terms of goals and assists. And that's not the player that Scanlon was this year. So when you look at him in the context of the rest of the talent on the team, you mentioned how much talent there is in the sophomore and junior classes from the midfield. I don't have an answer. All I'm saying is I'm really interested in what ends
now
up
here's my hot take. A midfield of Curry, Dordovic, and Scanlon could be the best in the country. The only two teams that jump out at me right now who could compete in that regard would be Virginia, with Docs Aiken, Moore, and maybe Schellenberger or somebody else, and maybe Yale, returning guys like Kotler, Tevlin, and whoever. They had a couple young freshmen last year that showed tremendous promise when I watched their practice. But Cuse could have the number one midfield in the country if that trio step on the field together.
Okay, here's my hot take. Two of those three guys are probably attackmen. I have wanted to see Brennan Curry operate from X,
exactly.
And
well,
I want to see Chase Scanlon as
right
that
right attackman.
Yeah, that right attackman.
Maybe that'll happen. maybe that'll happen. But again, you roll them, if you were able to roll them out as midfielders, you can't triple pole.
Right.
You can't triple pole them, is what I'm saying. So someone else is going to get a shorty. And I got to think that the last year's freshman, was it Cook, the little guy?
Yep.
Who runs around as an ex-guy. You know, he's a viable option. Cuse is in good shape next year. They're moving forward. And it's a big year for them. It's a huge year for Syracuse and Johns Hopkins lacrosse. I think both programs are at the crosshairs between yesteryear and the future of this game. And if both teams don't show progress, we could see changes.
Wow. Well, that's a great moment to end or a great comment to end this segment of the podcast with as we shift gears. Quint, it's been a really interesting summer for pro lacrosse, as we knew that it would be, and I want to start by getting your thoughts on the dynamic. You've been around Major League Lacrosse a fair amount, calling a number of games so far this year, and I know that you've been observing the Premier Lacrosse League from afar. I had an opportunity to attend a PLL event at Homewood Field, and I've watched a handful of other games from both leagues. So I'll just kind of keep it to an open table. Or
yeah,
what
I got a lot of polarizing thoughts. I'm going to keep them to myself right now. I'm trying to keep it positive, Terry, and I know, you know, it's an adversarial relationship that they have, and that's the way it's going to be for at least a year, and we'll see. But I've just been thrilled. I've watched a couple PLL games on TV. Their TV product is an A+. Their on the field product is spectacular, and Major League Lacrosse has been that way. You know, Joe and I did a game the other night, Thursday at Hofstra, and we were reminiscing. It's our 20th year doing games together. I think we did 15 years in a row or 13 years in a row of pro games, and just thinking about the great players and the battles and the rivalries, and it was just such a wonderful day to spend with Joe. But, you know, to see Dylan Malloy perform the way he did that afternoon with the intensity, the physicalness, to see New York rally back, yeah, you know, Greg Gerenlian's parents were in the audience. They've become longtime Lizards fans, and so there are loyalties that
across the aisle
that are undeniable. And then, you know, I've had the chance to watch Lyle Thompson this summer, and I've always been a big Lyle Thompson fan. Maybe not as much as Kark and Anish, because, you know, in my eyes, Lyle could never get Albany to the championship weekend. They weren't a complete team, and I think I've seen the fault in my analysis of Lyle, because what he has done this summer has been as good as any pro performer I've seen since 2000, let's say. I mean, he's been so dominant. I love his attitude, his passion, his purity, the depth of his skills, whether it's riding, ground balls, passing, scoring. It's been a joy to watch him play, and to see him alongside a guy like Steele Stanwyck, Colin Heacock, and then working with a youngster like Brendan Bomberry, I walk away from watching Lyle play just energized and enthused, you know, and I hope he continues to stay healthy and play at a high level and give the fans everything they deserve. And those are the positives that I'm seeing this summer.
Sure. So for me, one of the things that's the most important or broadest comment that I want to make about pro lacrosse, and certainly I want to start by saying that if you're interested in the on-field analysis, check out Kyle Devin and Chris Rosenthal, who produce a weekly pro lacrosse podcast here on the Inside Lacrosse Podcast Network. But beyond that, I want to say that folks have been critical of PLL for their attendance, the quality of the in-stadium experience, and some of the other elements of kind of that event operation and sales standpoint. And one of the things that occurred to me is that when, you know, from the moment that the league was announced in October up through when they played their first game, when you look at basically what Paul Rabel and Mike Rabel and other folks that were speaking on behalf of the league were doing so publicly, they were telling the truth in the sense that they cared the most about media consumption, particularly social media consumption, and they cared the most about the players' experience. And it's clear that those two priorities were prioritized above some of the other stuff that they're being criticized for now, such as ticket sales. And I guess, you know, you can question the wisdom of it, and
is there sustainability with money, with not being able to monetize that? This is just a general business question. You know, is there sustainability when you're not able to monetize that and you don't have money coming in the door from ticket sales and TV sponsorships when your TV ratings haven't kept pace with the quality of the product that's putting out there?
So
that's just my question. Business, it comes down to business model.
Right.
In my eyes, PLL is trying to be like the NFL. MLL is trying to be a little more like minor league baseball, let's say. Maybe somewhere in between is the ideal product. That's kind of where I'm looking this summer. You know, I think both leagues do things exceptionally well. And if we learn from one another, maybe we can get this right somehow.
So, yeah, I'm reserving judgment on a lot of aspects of this conversation until both seasons are over. For me,
and we're halfway.
Exactly,
PLL's halfway. MLL is about a third of the way through.
Yep,
a little more than that.
For me, I think that the financial outlooks of both organizations are similar in the sense that Major League Lacrosse, the owners need to ask themselves, like, what is our ongoing commitment? Because, you know, specifically with the, you know, in the wake of the contraction of three teams and Jim Davis owned franchises being consolidated into the Rattlers, to whatever degree that's a fair way of describing it. And then in the wake of Pat Bowlen's death and the questions that arises relative to the future ownership of the Broncos and the Outlaws, I think it's fair to ask, all right, well, we know that there are some really highly committed ownership groups and that they've been very outgoing in terms of their commitment to the future of the league. But the question that I have is, what does that mean for the other ownership groups? Because the Bayhawks and the Blaze and the league office are certainly committed. And now I think their priority needs to be similar to what the NLL priority has been over the last several years, which is bringing in new ownership groups. You know, and the comparative question for PLL is, you know, they have done a lot of work around promoting their investor group and the role that they have played, you know, and they've compared themselves routinely to a startup. And in so doing, they've essentially positioned themselves to know that they're going to have to go through multiple rounds of fundraising in order to be able to continue to sustain their costs into the future. We don't know what the cost and revenue models and the financial performances of both organizations are. And it's pretty hard to find out a lot of those things. And at some point, we might, at Inside Lacrosse, make the decision to try to do so. But what we can fairly, speculate about is, you know, what is going to be the MLL owners, you know, kind of long-term commitment, and what is the PLL investors' intermediate-term commitment going to be, and how does that net itself out?
Yeah, and these are questions that can't be answered right now. Personally, I see the scaling back of Major League Lacrosse as a long-term positive. To jettison franchises that are not successful is never negative. My bigger question, you know, last weekend, let's say, we had 8 pro games that were broadcasted. And I've always been one to say, hey, any lacrosse on TV is good lacrosse. The more we get out there, the better. But ultimately, you know, you'd want one or two signature games to draw the masses to. And is it oversaturated right now? You know, that's a question. There's so many layers and aspects of this that are fascinating.
And obviously that's why we're talking about it. But a couple more things that I wanted to discuss before we wind this question or this podcast down. And that is just kind of the grassroots recruiting landscape. Quint, you mentioned at the top that you've got an opportunity to be involved in a handful of events from Under Armour All-America to World Series Youth Lacrosse in Natown.
Well, yeah, you guys had your event last weekend. It was a tremendous success.
Yep.
I didn't catch it in person, but I caught a lot of clips online, high-level play. You know, these kids from these non-hotbed areas continue to make a statement between Under Armour. And then I was at World Series, that's the U13s, but the Naptown event had tons of teams as well. It just amazes me how many clubs there are out there. Just a massive scope of club lacrosse. And, you know, I expressed to you, I'm a little fearful, obviously. I grew up in an era where school-based lacrosse was king, where summer events were more about camps and learning than they were about showcases. There were occasional showcases, but it was a much smaller population of the player base. So again, it's changed, and we can't go back. That'll never happen. But just amazed at the quality of play. So many good players. You know, to that regard, Terry, I sent you a video of a a young athlete from Wisconsin who's kind of overlooked in the recruiting process. This kid by the name of Elijah Gash. And he was a great example. And I get a lot of videos sent to me. Rarely do I see an athlete of the quality of Elijah Gash, who played in Wisconsin for a year at St. Ambrose University. His dad is Sam Gash, former fullback with the Ravens and I believe the Packers. And somewhere along the line, this kid fell through the cracks, which you rarely see nowadays. And I sent his video to a bunch of college coaches, and they're all interested, and they're going to reach out to him, he's going to reach out to them. And it's just fascinating with the quality of players that I'm seeing from all around the country. And it just opened my eyes to, wow, that we really have grown this thing. And if you're only dealing with the premier programs, whether it's Team 91, Long Island Express, the Crabs, Dukes, Madlax, Sweetlax, Eclipse, then you may be missing the boat on some very talented players.
Well, along those lines, one of the things that has stood out to me this summer as the class of 2021 prepares for that moment of first contact, and, we've seen 35 Division I commitments since June 1st in the class of 2020, is that there's still a lot of guesswork around what the future of the recruiting landscape is going to look like in the wake of the April 2017 NCAA rule changes. And I think that's a really good thing for the sport. There's no question that the elimination of early recruiting has been positive with respect to removing some of the toxicity from this event landscape, whether it be sideline behavior or whatever else. I don't think it's completely removed it by any stretch of the imagination. But on the other hand, I also think that it's helped the college game kind of settle itself out as well. But the point I'm making is that this September is not going to be like last September when we had, on the boys' side, nearly 200 players in the class committed. This September will be pretty similar to next September, September of 2020, in terms of the way that the class of 22 gets recruited. But by the time that we have a good understanding of how the class of 2021's process unfolded with respect to the opportunities that were available to them, decisions will have already been made in many cases for next summer. And so the point that I'm making is we are still two summers away from the status quo kind of having been maintained and the new normal netting itself out in terms of the hierarchy of where do you go if you want to get this opportunity. And in the meantime, we're going to do our best to try to figure it out. But it's been fun to be a part of the process. I've sweated a lot on the sidelines, and I'm about to head out to another sideline to sweat again. Quint, you are on vacation in upstate New York, so we appreciate your time. We send our apologies to your family for taking you away from them for the last 40 minutes. But we hope that our listeners enjoyed this podcast. If you did, tell a friend, leave us a rating and review on Apple Podcasts or anywhere else where you are able to listen to this. And we don't know when we're going to be back, but when we are, we look forward to that. Quint, as always, thanks for joining us, and we will talk to you again soon.
Terry, I just want to finish up with one thing to our fans. Go to a pro game this summer, MLL, PLL, whatever it may be. Email me. It's quint@insidelacrosse.com. It's quint@insidelacrosse.com. Tell me about your experience. Tell me what was good. Tell me what was average. Tell me what was lacking. I think it's important that the fans get out there, support these pros, and then give us some feedback because we want to get this thing right.
Poke check, rap check, back check, slap check, testing 1, 2, 3. Poke check, rap check, back check, slap check.
Welcome to the Quick Restart. We cover 73 Division I men's lacrosse teams,
and we do it fast.